please, if you haven't gotten it already, please pick it up as soon as you can.
I think I just got the last one.
Well, maybe, maybe not. Okay. All right. There are going to be three speakers on this panel. Hopefully, none of us will speak for more than 20-odd minutes, and there'll be plenty of time, a good, you know, 45 minutes to 50 minutes for discussion. I'll be speaking first, followed by Kate Fox Hodges, who will be speaking, who teaches at Management in Sheffield. And then finally, Kim, who is at University of Westminster at this point, will be sort of responding to our comments and making some broader comments, and then we'll open it up. All right. For the last 20 or 25 years, people on the left in the United States, from the social democratic left on the right to certain variants of self-described left communism in the U.S. and in the English-speaking world, have been trying to figure out and trying to explain why the workers' movement that emerged in after the Second World War, actually the workers' movement of the 20th century, large industrial unions based on industrial workplaces, engaging in strike actions, coupled with mass working class political parties, labor, social democratic, or communist, that purported to represent the interests of workers in the electoral arena. This model of the workers' movement went into crisis in the mid to late 1970s, and since the 1980s has been in decline. And this is manifested in the decline in the size and influence of both unions at the workplaces and working class political parties across the global north, and in a sharp decline in strikes, at least in the United States, until recently last spring we saw, and I'm sure we'll discuss, a slight uptick. Now, for the most part, there's actually a general consensus on the left, at least in the United States, and I would probably argue more broadly, that the crisis of the 20th century workers' movement is rooted in fundamental changes in the sociological structure of capitalism and the working class. And while we can see that these various currents disagree about differ on the strategic conclusions, both certain self-described left communists and the mainstreams of the labor movement globally agree that neoliberalism has so fundamentally changed capitalism, the working class, that previous models of working class organization were not only had political problems, but were based on a social structure that no longer exists. And they tend to pinpoint three key changes. The first is what's referred to under the broad rubric of deindustrialization. The decline in the number of workers employed in manufacturing industry of the global north is seen as the combination of either increasing mechanization or the wholesale movement of manufacturing to the global south. The second structural change that has purportedly structurally weakened the working class is the growth of precarity, the disappearance of full-time stable employment, and the generalization of part-time and unstable employment. And finally, the third theme is financialization, that capitalist exploitation and profits are no longer being produced in manufacturing, in the production of actual material goods and services, but a shift in capitalist exploitation to the extraction of financial profits. Taken together, the argument is these profound sociological changes have undermined the stably employed industrial working class who were the subject of the 20th century workers' movement. Now, interestingly, we can see this in two very different sets of literatures. You see this argument very clearly put forward in Joshua Clover's Riot, Strike, Riot, his 2016 book published by Verso. There he argues that capitalism has been in a permanent crisis since the mid-60s, which is the result of the decline of U.S. hegemony in the world economy. Put simply for him, production no longer generates profits. This has produced the deindustrialization of the global north, which he sees as a combination of both some movement of what remaining manufacturing exists to the global south and automation, a growing precarity of employment, the growth of what he calls a permanent surplus population, and the dominance of circulation and finance over production. For him, this results in the decline of the traditional industrial working class and the strike, and the rise of surplus populations and what he calls riot prime. I could go into more details, etc., but basically for Clover and for the political currents who reference his work, the idea of the strike, the idea of organized workers capable of shutting down capitalist production, challenging the rule of capital, and possibly reorganizing society, quoted, as Marx put it, in their own image, is no longer a possibility. Instead, we have surplus populations, large layers of unemployed and semi-employed people who can riot, disrupt society, and somehow effectuate an unspecified transition to an unspecified commune. What's interesting is, though they draw a completely different set of strategic conclusions, the same basic analysis of how capitalism has changed is evident in materials from the mainstream of the labor officialdom around the world. There's an amazing report by the International Labor Organization called Policies and Regulations to Combat Precarious Employment, along with position papers published by the FL-CIO, the equivalent of the TUC in the US, on trade, finance, etc., in the last 5 years. And again, the labor bureaucracy is saying capital began, for them, it's not an inherent crisis or permanent crisis of capitalism. For them, capital has violated the social compact that was supposedly coalesced at the end of the Second World War, in which workers would get higher wages, social benefits of various sorts, in exchange for greater productivity and the like. Capital has reneged on this, and we now have trade agreements which allow industry to move offshore, decline of manufacturing, growing precarity of employment, growing financialization, etc. Their solution is not the riot and the unspecified commune, but the restoration of proper capitalist state regulation of the relationship between capital and labor, some sort of restoration on a new basis of the post-war compromise. Now, Kim's book, I think, is a powerful antidote to these analyses. Particularly, it is an empirical and theoretical challenge to the claims of deindustrialization and precarity. Kim points out that neoliberalism has actually seen a quantitative expansion in the real inflation-adjusted value of industrial production, which includes not only manufacturing, but construction, resource extraction, telecommunications, and transport and logistics. He points out that the drop in employment in traditional manufacturing is not the result of offshoring, globalization, but important gains in productivity flowing from lean production, the massive increase in absolute surplus value extraction over the last 30 years, and increased mechanization, increases in relative surplus value. Workers in these industries still have tremendous potential social power because of the growing masses of fixed capital that they set in motion. There's also been, as employment in manufacturing has declined and surplus and the relative surplus population, the reserve army has been renewed, new sectors of capitalist industry, which have concentrated workers with potential, nothing spontaneous, nothing automatic, potential social power. In particularly, the transports and logistics industries with their highly concentrated, urbanized, and increasingly multiracial workforces. We've also seen in the last 30 or 40 years the intensification of processes that we've seen since the Second World War, one we could call the socialization or industrialization of the social reproduction of labor power, particularly in healthcare and education. These are large and concentrated workplaces that where semi-professionals are experiencing increasing routinization of their work, falling wages, and a growing de-skilling of their work. Finally, is this finally? Okay. Finally, Kim points out that that claims about precarity and the growth of part-time temporary employment have been greatly exaggerated. He provides very firm statistical data that the bulk of the working class remains in full-time, year-round, and long-tenured work. However, that work has become both less remunerative and more stressful, with falling wages, declining benefits, and the generalized intensification of work across the capitalist world. The work is also experienced to be more precarious because of the dismantling of the remnants of the welfare state, which have raised the cost to individual workers and their households of any period of unemployment or underemployment. Put simply, the crisis of the 20th century labor movement is a political strategic crisis. While the working class was, as it has been several times in the history of industrial capitalism, recomposed, it has not disappeared nor lost its structural capacity to change the world. However, what is clear is that the old forms of workers' organizations, large bureaucratic unions, and reformist political parties that rely on the state to balance the interests of capital and labor are inadequate. A new workers' movement, a new political recomposition of the working class, will not involve either the emergence of a new revolutionary subject among the surplus population or the revival of old bureaucratic forms of organization. Instead, a renewal of working class organization and radicalism will come from where it has always come in the past two centuries, a revival of working class activity and self-organization from below in the form of massive and often illegal strikes that bring workers together across the barriers of race and gender, inspire disruptive social movements outside the workplace, and create new forms of political representation of the working class, which we can see in very embryonic forms in the United States last spring with the wave of teacher strikes in the so-called red states and with the renewal of a socialist movement in the U.S. and with low, and I'm sure Kim will touch on this, he talks about quite a bit in the book, some real initiatives at independent working class political activity in the electoral region. Now, this will not take place spontaneously or automatically, even among workers with the greatest potential structural power. Workers face very different conditions of struggle and need to develop strategy, tactics that maximize their structural power and minimize the impact of repressive and bureaucratic legal and political structures. However, these legal and political structures are themselves the product of past class structures, struggles, and can be altered very fundamentally as they have in the past by new waves of struggle in the future. Thanks.
So that was a really nice overview of the book. And in my remarks today, I'm going to focus in on just one of the arguments in the book, which is the argument on the sort of potentialities of organizing the logistics industry. So this is sort of closest to my own research on dock workers' unions and my own kind of interests coming out of the trade union movement, having worked as an organizer in the warehouse sector. So broadly, my remarks today will focus on what I see as both the strengths and the limitations of Kim's conceptualization of worker power in the logistics industry. So respectively, I see the strengths of the argument in terms of its grounding in the material realities of the economy. Right. The limitation I see of the framework is the neglect of the role of the state in shaping these economic realities. And I'm going to explain further what I mean by that. So while capital has certainly reshaped the battleground of class war, I argue that for strategic industries like logistics in particular, this reshaping of the economic sphere takes place as much through sins of omission, commission, and constitution on the part of the relatively autonomous capitalist state as it does through the market and the production process. bringing the capitalist state's role in shaping the terrain of struggle at the point of production back into the picture, therefore provides insights into why the predicted or hoped for upsurge within the logistics sector has not yet occurred. And I hope that by doing so, by bringing the role of the capitalist state back in, this will better inform organizing strategy in the sector in the future. So to develop his analysis of the potential for labor movement revitalization on the new terrain, Kim draws heavily from Hal Draper's work, which represents, quote, the working class as concentric circles from an industrial core to outer rings of workers, presumably less concentrated or less likely to be direct producers of surplus value. So Kim demonstrates that the composition of the core has changed over time with the shrinking of the manufacturing and mining workforce, for example, as a percentage of the total. And recent decades have witnessed increasing concentration of and centralization of capital in the U.S., as well as greater capital intensity in the workplace. These trends should create vulnerabilities for capital, giving workers greater power to organize and bargain, but Kim argues that instead the trend has been wage stagnation with growing productivity up to the present. At the same time as the relative decline and contraction of key industries, however, other sectors, in particular services and logistics, have grown dramatically. So while Kim locates service workers outside of the core in the first sort of concentric circle following Draper's model, he argues that they've been brought, quote, closer to the core in their conditions and settings of work and in the leverage they have over capital's restructured and reorganized processes of production. Nevertheless, from Kim's perspective, the real key to unlocking the puzzle of trade union movement revitalization is logistics, right? So logistics workers have always been part of the core, but they play an ever more important role within it. As he puts it, quote, it's fair to say that these logistics workers have at least as much leverage in the economy of today as auto workers did in the 1970s. So in a nutshell, the logistics sector constitutes the worker movement's best hope for the next upsurge because, quote, one of the most important changes in the reorganization of supply chains is their geography, the concentration of workers in key nodes or clusters, along with their technological drivers and linkages. If suppliers have relocated to lower cost areas within the United States or even offshore, bringing about a degree of vertical disintegration, the sinews of transportation that move both intermediate and final products, including imports within the United States, have been reconfigured into enormous logistics clusters of transportation hubs, massive warehouses and distribution centers, aerotropolises, seaports, intermodal yards, and sophisticated technology that bring tens of thousands of workers into finite geographic concentrations, mostly in or adjacent to large metropolitan areas. So additionally, the sector is characterized by increasingly integrated supply chains utilizing fewer suppliers, big sunk capital investments, and a high degree of geographical fixity as a result of the inability or difficulty of offshoring production. So this industrial concentration and fixity in turn has required a sizable workforce located in or near the urban hubs, which have so often been the site of labor struggles, because of the possibilities they afford for building connections with broader communities. Kim argues that the history of the worker movement suggests that when the sector does get organized, it will likely occur, quote, rapidly in the midst of explosive and usually unpredictable strike waves, rather than an evenly rising slope. Yet, given the apparent potentialities of worker organizing in the logistics sector, why has an upsurge thus far failed to emerge? This is what I really want to focus on here. So as I've said, Kim locates the potentialities of the logistics worker organizing in the material realities of the production process, the circulation process, and labor geographies. The social and, above all, political forces shaping these material realities, however, remain somewhat obscure in the book, in my view. Most significantly, without delineating the role of the capitalist state in shaping the terrain of struggle for workers in the economic sphere, I argue that the constraints that workers organizing in the logistics sector will need to confront in order to successfully contest the imperatives of capital remain somewhat unclear. So I want to just, as a caveat, say that the book, of course, can hardly be accused of neglecting the state. The final section of the book in its entirety focuses on a careful analysis of the difficulties socialists face within the U.S. political system. Kim argues that because of capital's tremendous success in radically downgrading the possibilities for labor to see its interests represented in government, he sensibly proposes that socialists in the United States should concentrate on building up autonomous political organization from the local level, where there's the greatest possibility of accountability and momentum through meaningful connection to workplace and social movement organizing. And I fully agree with his prognosis. Yet, I would argue that the book as a whole remains somewhat bifurcated between the economic story of the first half and the political story of the second half. So in the narrative, the capitalist economy and the capitalist state appear as more or less self-contained units. So the former, the capitalist economy, throws up possibilities for building worker power in the logistics sector, and the latter, the capitalist state, constrains the possibilities for building worker power in the political sphere. Now, I argue that this bifurcation, as a result, produces an analysis that encompasses capital's role in reshaping the terrain of production and circulation on the one hand, and the terrain of political contestation on the other, but is relatively silent on the ways in which capital's reshaping of the political terrain in turn reshapes the economic terrain for worker organizing. And I argue that we need to sort of further theorize the role of the capitalist state in shaping this economic terrain, particularly for logistics workers, so that we can develop appropriate strategy and tactics for organizing. So to sort of develop this type of a framework where we can think about how the capitalist state matters when it comes to logistics worker organizing, I turn to the work of Nikos Poulantzis, whose contributions to Marxist state theory remain unparalleled. In State Power Socialism, Poulantzis criticizes the tendency within Marxist theory to reduce the state's role to its repressive and ideological functions. Though repression and ideology remain central to Poulantzis's conception of the capitalist state, his key contribution with respect to our understanding of the constitution of worker power in the economy is his insistence that, quote, the political field of the state, as well as the sphere of ideology, has always, in different forms, been present in the constitution and reproduction of the relations of production. Breaking with Marxist orthodoxy, Poulantzis therefore argues that the, quote, power of the class is defined by its, quote, place, objective place in economic, political, and ideological relations. So examining the possibility that the power of logistics sector workers is determined as much by political and ideological dimensions as it is by economic dimensions, in particular the capitalist state's repressive ideological and constituent functions in the economy, I argue provides essential insights into the challenges workers face in organizing the sector. I'm going to skip ahead a bit. I argue that any understanding of the capitalist state's role in shaping the terrain of struggle in the logistics sector must begin by analyzing its constitutive functions in the economy. So beginning in the 1970s, with the falling rate of profit for U.S. capital as a result of labor's post-war gains and rising intercapitalist competition, this generated the need for a sea shift in strategies of accumulation, which Kim, I think, certainly demonstrates in the book, right? So capital adopted strategies in the workplace, through the labor process, and in the marketplace, through the dispersion of production globally and the growth of logistics that this entailed. But we need to think as well about the role of the capitalist state in facilitating these processes and the implications for labor struggle, right? So in fact, I argue that the rise of logistical capitalism would not have been possible without a constellation of state policy decisions that have facilitated both the profitability of global supply chains and the need to develop logistical capacities. The rise of global supply chains, and thus the logistics industry, relied on the creation of new geographies separating consumer markets from commodity production. Production has proportionally shifted away from the global north to countries whose competitive advantage and strategy for growth relies on a state-led low-road strategy of low wages, depressed regulatory environments, privatization of public assets, extractivism, and opportunities for foreign direct investment. By contrast, the mid-century developmental state in the global south sought to build up internal markets, in part through subsidizing sectors engaged in higher value-added activities, which also tended to facilitate the growth of strong worker movements. The subsequent shift toward the low road strategy in much of the global south has not been accomplished through the market alone, however, but through loan conditionalities, free trade agreements, and the like that have been pushed through as a result of the highly asymmetrical power relationships between wealthy states in the north and impoverished states in the south. However, the profitability of the logistics industry in the global north has also depended heavily on deliberate state action and inaction within the north. So the deregulation of the trucking industry in the United States and the long-term impacts on both working conditions and worker organizing in the sector is a case in point. So I'm going to go through this example a bit to sort of illustrate what I mean by this. So until the deregulation of the trucking industry through the Motor Carriers Act in 1980, truck drivers in the United States were among the best organized workers in the country. In the mid-1970s, the Teamsters represented over 2 million drivers nationally. Just 3 years prior to deregulation, more than 80% of workers in the industry were unionized, and their average annual pay in 2018 dollars was nearly $100,000 a year. Following deregulation, their wages, working conditions, and union density dropped precipitously, and today their conditions of employment have frequently been described as sweatshops on wheels. Currently, the Teamsters represent just 75,000 drivers nationally, out of approximately 3.5 million drivers in the country, a rate of unionization lower than the appallingly low private sector average of 6.5%. So, and of course, that also has to do with problems in the union, and I would be the first to accept that. The dramatic transformation of the collective power of the workforce, however, was accomplished through a process of reclassifying drivers as independent owner-operators, functionally dependent on employees, as employees on their clients, though legally prohibited from unionization and collective bargaining on the basis of their supposed status as employers. Efforts to organize even those drivers in direct employment relations with big public-facing companies have met with only limited success under the circumstances. At the same time, the effect on the growth of the logistics industry was profound. Trucking costs, which represent about half of the total logistics expenditures, are about 40% lower today than they were prior to deregulation. So the example of the nearly complete decimation of union density in the trucking industry through deregulation and fragmentation of employment provides a particularly vivid illustration of how the state's constitutive role in the economy shapes the terrain of struggle for workers. But the state's constitutive role is everywhere in evidence, right? So the exceptionally weak labor law regime in the U.S. is a case in point, where enforcement mechanisms and penalties for anti-union activity are toothless enough for most large employers to simply laugh away. Coupled with the retrenchment of a social welfare state that even at its peak provided far less protection than that of other wealthy capitalist democracies, many workers otherwise fed up with their conditions of employment may feel too intimidated to organize, knowing that the state will not protect them legally or socially should they be fired. There's every reason to think, therefore, that far from challenging capital through economically based power alone, workers in strategic industries like logistics are far more likely to become vulnerable to state action as their collective power grows. And dock workers, the group of workers that I study, provide a clear demonstration of this principle. Within the logistics sector, perhaps no single group of workers are more strategic. Small in numbers, highly skilled, and located at the nodal points of international commerce, their ability to disrupt the circulation of commodities is arguably unparalleled by any other group of workers in the economy. Moreover, dock workers in the U.S., as in most of the global north, have nearly 100% union density and are organized into powerful trade unions. The West Coast Dock Workers Union in the U.S. in particular has a long history of militancy, which it's used both in defense of members' working conditions and to advance broader political aims. Yet in key disputes in 1971 and 2002, Nixon and Bush intervened directly in their disputes by invoking Taft-Hartley, the 1947 anti-union law that allows the federal government to order workers back to the job during strikes or lockouts. In fact, these are the only times this law has been successfully invoked in the U.S. since 1971. A similar case from 2011, in which Obama essentially threatened to militarize the docks, is another case in point. I argue that this unprecedented level of state repression is, of course, no accident. It's the result, instead of a process by which the state routinely intervenes to discipline workers in key sectors where they're too powerful to be effectively confronted by capital alone. Consequently, and perhaps counterintuitively, we may draw the conclusion that the most strategic position for workers from an economic perspective can simultaneously be the weakest position from a political and ideological perspective. And this is an argument I'm going to be developing in the plenary session later today. So a final dimension of the capitalist state's role in shaping the terrain of struggle within the economy concerns the state's ideological functions. This dimension is particularly salient today, both in the US and many other parts of the world, given the rise of the far right. State ideologies such as racism serve to divide the workforce just as much as they divide the polity. These politically constructed fissures, often embedded in law, have profound consequences for organizing. They're all the more pronounced when they overlay stark divisions between skilled permanent workers and unskilled temporary or agency workers, as is characteristic of the logistics industry. In a recent article for Viewpoint magazine, drawing on a case from warehouse sector organizing in northern Italy, the authors argued that these race-based hierarchies embedded in immigration and labor law pose the single most fundamental challenge to organizing in the sector. Similar race-based hierarchies are very much in evidence in the warehouse sector in the United States. A researcher looking at a Teamsters organizing effort in the Port of LA Long Beach, for example, documented a pattern of assigning Latino workers to higher skilled and supervisorial positions with direct employment relationships, while Black workers were assigned to lower skilled, non-supervisorial, and often temporary positions. And the researcher identified that as the key challenge they faced in organizing there. Right. So thus, while I think that Kim is very, very right, almost done, to note that the logistics industry employs a higher than average proportion of workers of color who are statistically much more likely than white workers to have positive views of trade unions, this will not translate into straightforward gains for the worker movement unless these internal divisions constructed through dominant state ideologies can be overcome. Okay, I'm going to just skip ahead because we're out of time here. I think I'll just stop there.
Okay, thank you, Charlie and Katie. Actually, I agree with most of what Katie had to say, and it's not all in the book. I suppose I would have a couple of things. I don't think that the racial divisions in the United States are a product of the state. I think they're a product of American history, are profound, deep, and affect everything, but also there are enough precedents in American labor history to show that under the right circumstances and with any kind of intelligent leadership, these can be overcome in terms of struggle. Mm-hmm. And this is the whole thing. You know, in a certain part of the book, where I'm talking about the possibility of an upsurge and everything. I'm not predicting it, but about the possibilities. And what I just want to say about that is I think, yes, I didn't really go into the role of the state, adequately in the book, but I think that consciousness is something that is transformed by struggle. And that if and when these kind of struggles begin to take place, I mean, we heard the other day in terms of the teachers' strikes on a panel I was on, you know, the transformation of people's consciousness in that process. We're talking about a couple of weeks, with much more previous organizing, of course, before the strikes. And the consciousness was to the point where in West Virginia, where 40% of the teachers were Republicans, by the end of the strike, most of them were no longer Republicans. Whether they became Democrats or whatever is not necessarily that great leap forward, but nonetheless, they had abandoned a piece of ideology that probably, you know, they had for a long time. It wasn't something they just picked up from Trump or anything like that. The transformation of the state as something in West Virginia has been going on for decades. so that kind of thing, I tend to generally, more than maybe other people on the left, to discount ideological arguments, because when you do look at historical examples of struggle and of upsurges in labor, it's not so much that they disappear, but they recede. Now, they may return, you know, when things don't go so well, because they never quite go away. That isn't going to happen until, I don't know, generations after the revolution, to put it one way. But nonetheless, I think that's true. Everything that Katie said about deregulation is absolutely essential to this whole thing. There would be no intermodal transport in the United States without not just deregulation of trucking, but of rail and air and just about everything else in the early 80s. So that is all an important dimension. And in fact, I'm going to cheat a little bit today, and I'm not going to talk much about logistics because it's been covered pretty well here, as much as I usually do, because half the book is actually about politics, American mainstream politics, and the left's attempt to approach this and deal with this. And I think this is extremely important. Let me put it this way. In looking at various things since the Tuesday elections, the midterm elections in the United States that saw the Democrats regain the House of Representatives and lose somewhat in the Senate, and I'll explain why that was easily explained, actually. If you read some of the left things, the response, for example, of the National Secretary of DSA or things in these times, these are people or publications that tend to lean towards the idea that the left, the socialist left, not just the liberal left, the socialist left can make gains by intervening in the Democratic Party, running in primaries and so forth, electing people. And of course, if you have followed the election at all, it's new and it's still hard to find definitive numbers on all these things, but I've looked at just about everything you can get your hands on. The thing that encourages the left are particularly two congressional elections in which women of color, socialists, members of Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, won their congressional election. So for the first time in generations, there are socialists who call themselves that sitting in Congress. There have been other DSAers before, but they weren't open about it. So that's a kind of interesting change. But on the basis of that and some other elections at the lower level, there's a kind of optimistic note that comes forth from a lot of people on the left about the possibilities of following this, and of actually making the Democratic Party move to the left. Now, let me say about that, the Democratic Party is perfectly capable of moving to the left, considering where it's been for the last 30 or 40 years. Moving to the left, meaning, taking on a populist tone, for example. Obama did in one of his elections, and then that gets forgotten immediately, of course. Or it may even mean taking up some policy issues that they haven't done for a while down the road. I think, though, that it's important to understand why this perspective of the left building a mass political socialist movement within the context of the Democratic Party is not only unlikely, but I would argue an impossibility. First of all, it's been tried before many times. There's nothing new about this. I don't want to go into all the history of it. It's in the book. I go through it in some detail. And of course, the irony is that every time it's been tried, it seems to be at exactly the moment that the Democratic Party moves to the right. So socialists intervene, the party moves to the right. Now, I'm not saying there's a causal relationship. I won't blame Michael Harrington for the party's shift to the right in the 1980s or 70s. But nonetheless, this kind of shows the futility of those kind of approaches. People have a slightly different idea of how to do it now than back in the 70s and 80s, but nonetheless, I spend a lot of time in the second half of the book talking about what the Democratic Party is. And this is important, because part of the analysis that says we can maybe not take it over, but influence it or move it somewhat, is based on the notion that, well, it isn't actually really a party, is it? Mm. It has no membership. You can't join it. I mean, you sign up with the state register, you know, with the state to be a Democrat or a Republican or a Green or whatever it is, but you're not a member of the Democratic Party. There's no democracy in this organization, and you can win office by winning the primary. And yes, anybody can run for a primary. I mean, you do need a little money, or maybe more than a little money, and so forth, but you can do this, as we have seen in this election. A couple of people did it, and lower levels, like state levels, you know, maybe a couple or more dozen people have succeeded, although I looked at the figures, and the proportion of people who were endorsed by, say, Our Revolution, which is Bernie Sanders, it really isn't his, but I mean, he encouraged this thing. They endorse people they think are left progressives. The vast majority of their candidates lost, but I guess they can't be blamed for that. Of the 10 who won congressional districts, 4 were incumbents, which means this wasn't very difficult, and 2 were the 2 DSAers who won and ran unopposed in the election. So the progress on this front was not particularly great. Perhaps this was not the time to do that. But the problem with the Democratic Party is that its structures, its official structures, and it has these, and people tend to dismiss them, but I think that's a mistake. These are conduits for capital, money, conduits for capitalist money. People think, oh, aren't they funded by the labor movement? The answer is tiny bit compared to corporate and business and wealthy people's money. And I go into considerable detail there. You can look at the more updated figures from this election. You'll see the same thing. By the way, this is the most expensive midterm election in American history. And not surprisingly, because actually each year, each election gets more expensive, because that's what part of is going on. The way you win office, to a large extent, not always, but to a large extent, is by how much money you throw into the thing. And so, for example, Elizabeth Warren won her election this year. She is the left liberals' hope for the future. And also many socialists think that she is the hope of the future. Her senatorial election was the second most expensive senatorial election in American history, at $32 million plus dollars. The first one was her last election in 2012 at $42 million. So this gives you an idea that even the left liberals and so forth get into office by money. It isn't all corporate money. She takes some, most take more, and so forth. But this ability of the dependence of the Democratic Party's structures and most of their candidates, there are exceptions, but most of the candidates, on this kind of money is completely well documented, not only in my book, but you can go find these things online and so forth. So that's one thing. Let's look at this particular election. And let me go back to what I said about the Senate. Well, how is it that if the Democrats got the House, the Republicans can get the Senate? Well, you have to know a little bit about American politics to know just how unbalanced they are and everything else. Representatives to the House of Representatives in Congress are elected from districts that all of which, theoretically at least, have more or less the same population, which is about 675,000 people last time I looked. The Senate, however, every state gets 2 senators, no matter how rural and how small their population is. So little Rhode Island gets 2 senators, or rural Wyoming gets 2 senators, just like urban New York or California, et cetera. Okay. So that's how they won the House. The Republicans are now the party of rural America, the Democrats of urban America, to put it crudely, and so forth. How did the Democrats win this election. They won it by having a strategy of going after suburban, upper middle income, suburban Republican districts, Republican held districts, and they won them. Now, this has a consequence. How did they win them? Not by being democratic socialists, believe me, but by being moderates and saying, well, we're going to be bipartisan and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Most of the Democrats who ran this time ran as moderates. That means that now that they control the House, what are they going to do? Well, the answer is not very much, and most people are saying this, because first of all, they can't do very much in terms of legislation, because nothing will get past the Senate. So mostly what they will do is what's called oversight, and they can actually do some damage to Trump, you know, and let's hope they do, through oversight and subpoenas and so forth, through hearings and all of that, publicity, and so on. The other thing about the new Congress is that the leader of this new Congress unquestionably is going to be, once again, Nancy Pelosi, who is the, what can I say, the police person of the center-right of the party and of the old guard. That means the way the party's congressional caucus is structured and everything, that she will control most of the committee appointments, and if you don't get a good committee appointment, you know, you don't have much influence, etc. What I'm saying, to make it short, is that for most part, this congressional Democratic Congress is going to be extremely moderate and pretty old guard, despite the presence of a few more radical people. So I think it's important to kind of understand that. And that is why I spend a lot of time in the book saying, well, if we're going to do electoral politics, and here the caveat, I also make it, I look at some of these European new developments like Podemos and some of the others, and they have a problem. A lot of them start, well, not a lot of them, but some of them start, like Podemos, from movements in the streets. You know, and this is what gives them their initial power. But as they become electoralists, that kind of goes to the wayside, and they become more concerned with winning elections. And of course, organizing to win an election is very different from organizing a mass base in the streets or in the neighborhoods or in the workplace. And so what I'm saying in the book is that if you're not going to organize in the streets, in the workplace, etc., you're not going to get anywhere. That without, in American politics, things change because of, 2 minutes? Things change because of mass movements. You can see this in the civil rights era, the 1930s with the labor movement and so forth. And then what happens? In those cases, they get absorbed by the Democratic Party and the reform agenda disappears and the party moves more and more towards the center or even to the right. So in order to avoid that bad dynamic, if there's going to be an upsurge, and this is part of what I'm arguing, that it's important now, in this period we're looking at, to do the grassroots type of organizing, the workplace organizing in particular, because, of course, Katie is right, the state will come down on these warehouse workers and truckers and all the rest of them. They already do. When Walmart workers struck a Walmart warehouse outside of Chicago in 2014, who did the state send in? Just the ordinary police? No, they actually sent in the state terrorist unit to put down this strike. Mm-hmm. You know, the warehouse must be full of terrorists because we know a lot of them come from Latin America. So Trump tells us that, you know, all that bullshit. So yes, the state will definitely intervene, as it always has, mm-hmm. as it always has. But what I would say, you know, the power, and this is my argument in there, the power is there because of the vulnerability of this whole new logistics system. Mm-hmm. And I've actually written since the book, which will come out next year, which I go into more detail about why that is, why the dynamics of capitalist competition exist within these supply chains, despite all the algorithms and the digital driving of these things and so forth, that make these supply chains and the logistics system much more vulnerable than even old industry was, you know, when we had that back in the day and so forth. So what I'm saying is the whole argument, and of course it's common sense, it should be to any socialist, and so forth, is that our power exists through organization, through grassroots organization. And if we don't have that, if the unions just come back to this sector and do the same old routine they used to do, trying to use the law, trying to just mobilize for a brief period of time, getting people to sign cards and vote for the union, if that's all they're going to do, it's not going to work. It's going to have to come from below, and so I think that is what I'm trying to get at in this book. Thank you.